I want to take a second to remind you to sign up for the Poso Daily Brief. It is completely free. It'll be one email that's sent to you every day. You can stop the endless scrolling, trying to find out what's going on in your world. We will have this delivered directly to you, totally for free. Go to humanevents.com/Poso. Sign up today. It's called the Poso Daily Brief. Read what I read for show prep. You will not regret it. Humanevents.com/Poso. Totally free. The Poso Daily Brief.
This is what happens when the fourth turning meets fifth generation warfare.
A commentator, international social media sensation, and former Navy intelligence veteran.
This is Human Events with your host, Jack Posobiec.
Deliver us from
the
evil.
The judge in New York has just denied Trump's request to move the hush money trial set to start next week. His attorneys had argued on behalf of that request in court 2 hours ago. Trump's request for a stay of the gag order imposed by Judge Juan Merchan is still pending.
My view is now that we have abortion where everybody wanted it from a legal standpoint, the states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land. In this case, the law of the state.
Andrew Cherkasky. So Donald Trump was able to post a $175 million bond. He did it with a bond agency. Now AG Letitia James says the agency that wrote the bond for Trump is not qualified to do so. So she's reportedly beginning the process of claiming Trump's properties. Is this ever going to end?
And the Vatican has released its highly anticipated infinite dignity doctrine. The 20-page report rejects gender-affirming surgery, surrogacy, and gender theory, calling them, quote, the greatest threats to human dignity.
Israel says it has now set a date for an invasion of the city of Rafah, despite strong objections from the United States. Palestinians are returning to scenes of destruction in areas where Israeli troops have pulled out for now. As Holly Williams reports, many are finding there's hardly anything left of their homes.
Ukraine's president is giving his strongest, starkest warning yet about the state of the war against Russia without military aid from the United States.
If Congress does not help Ukraine, Ukraine will lose the war. And we need to find a public format for this. If Ukraine loses the war, other states will be attacked.
Volodymyr Zelensky also says Russia will soon be, quote, more and more insistent on dragging nuclear weapons into his debate.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard today's edition of Human Events Daily, powered by the folks here at Human Events. Today is April 9th, 2024, Anno Domini, live from Washington, D.C. Folks, I got a message out there for the conservatives, for the Republicans. You know, it really strikes me as strange that there are so many people that I will see on Twitter, on social media, and they are complaining about what's going on. They're arguing, they're yelling, they're so upset. Why did this thing happen? Why did that thing happen? When we should have had something else. We should be doing something better. We should be doing something that's perfect. Never let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Never let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Do we live in a perfect world? No, we do not. Perfection is not found this side of heaven. Perfection is not found this side of heaven. What do I mean by this? I mean specifically, when I find ourselves locked in battle with the unhumans. I'm not talking about the rank and file on the left. I'm talking about the leaders of the far, far radical left, the most radical left we've ever seen in this country, who are poised to take over every single last institution and already have in many cases. But we have a chance to do something about it. We have a chance to do something about it right here and right now. And it's called getting behind Donald J. Trump. We talked about this yesterday. But it's interesting to me that conservatives don't seem to understand how power structures work. You see, the left, all they do is care about power. It's all they focus on. They get a little bit of power, and they use that power to get more power. And then they continue to accumulate power. They don't campaign on the things that they believe because they know it would never work. They just campaign on things they know are popular, and then they use that to accumulate power. Republicans, on the other hand, would rather argue and debate and have these ridiculous purity tests and purity spirals all the way down rather than actually do the hard work of digging in and accumulating power. And then using that power, I know this is crazy. I knew this is going to sound nuts. Using that power to their advantage. Nope. No, they'd much rather purity spiral out and not actually win anything and not actually do anything and sit on the sidelines and argue about the people who are in the fight and doing things that, but no. And this is where, of course, you get where people say, oh, you're not allowed to say that about whatever issue it is. Oh, you're not paying enough fealty to some foreign country. You're not paying enough fealty to Ukraine or some other country that's not part of the United States. Like, look over here. NATO. Oh, Trump says something about NATO. Oh, no. Not the United States. Not the United States. There's two countries in the world. There's the United States and there's not the United States. Understand how power structures work. Understand how purity spirals destroy access to power. Senator Curl and Tony Schieffer wins next.
What really went down? So I'm jumping on my computer, going to pre-order town.
Ladies and gentlemen, one of the best ways that you can support us here at Human Events and the work that we do is subscribing to us on our Rumble channel. Make sure you're subscribed. You hit the notifications so you'll never miss a clip. You'll never miss a new live episode, and we're putting them out every single day of the week.
Far, but I got a hankering, a yearning deep inside. For this book called Unhumans, I just can't hide.
Here we're back live, Human Events Daily. Jack Posobiec here, Washington, D.C. Folks, the world is quickly descending into chaos. And the next medical crisis is just around the corner. Now, whether it's another pandemic or something closer to home, preparedness is no longer an option. It's now a necessity. That's where the wellness company comes in. From something innocent and natural like a tick bite to COVID to the next bioweapon manufactured in a lab, the wellness company's medical emergency kit is what you need to be prepared. It contains life-saving medications like ivermectin, emergency antibiotics, a Z-Pak, and so much more, as well as a guidebook to aid in the safe use of these life-saving medications. The wellness company and their doctors, including Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Reich, Dr. Drew Pinsky, Dr. Robert Seek, and more, are medical professionals that you can trust. Rest assured knowing that you're ready for whatever the globalists throw at us next. To order, just go to twc.health/poso. That's twc.health/poso and enter promo code POSO for 10% off. The wellness company and their licensed doctors are medical professionals and you can trust, and their medical emergency kits are the gold standard to keeping you safe. Again, that's twc.health/poso, promo code POSO for 10% off. See the site for details, and a prescription may be required. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schieffer joins us now. Tony, since the last time you and I have been on, we've been seeing a ton happening in Ukraine. Now, I remember it's been, a couple of months since you and I said that we're going to see the Syrianization of Ukraine. What does that mean? Militias are going to come in. We're going to have situations where the line of contact essentially splits the country down the middle. And we also talked about the fact that you were going to see the normalization of NATO soldiers and NATO troops coming in, particularly in the West. Now, and at the time, it was, Tony and Posobiec are nuts. No one's talking about that. No one's saying that. And now all of a sudden, we've got Emmanuel Macron. You've got the new government of Poland, the liberal government of Poland talking about this. What's the state of play, and what does this actually mean over there?
So the overall status is that, I'll just be blunt, Ukraine is lost. They weren't going to win. You and I have been very consistent on this point, Jack. It's like, the numbers aren't there. I'm sorry. You know, as intelligence guys, I'm not going to put a smiley face on inevitable defeat. And that's where we are. So right now, the Russians are using Ukraine as a military petri dish because of the very thing you're talking about. There's disarray. The Ukrainians are all kind of all over the place. By the way, the Azov Brigade, I've always thought of them as a militia more than an army, a unit, just saying, based on who they are and what they do. But it is, you know, Balkanization, Syrianization, whatever you want to call it. It's just not going well for Ukraine. And what's notable is that the Russians are building momentum. I mean, real momentum. I will use the word which best describes their ability: impunity. They can move with impunity pretty much anywhere they want to go. They've defeated the Ukrainian Air Force. They have left the army in disarray. Can the Ukrainian army fight back? Yeah, a little bit. They're making points of resistance. But at this point, literally, Jack, the Russians are so confident they're literally using new technologies, new weaponized technology, as a big petri dish, as a testing bed for new technologies that they're going to put on the battlefield. So, any measure of military progress that I can think of, the Russians are dominating. The Ukrainians are quickly losing any ability to hold them back.
And so, now, why is it that you can say that as an analyst? Look, I could say that looking at this as an analyst and just you know, take all the moralizing out of it and to say this is clearly a situation that is going in one direction and has gone in one direction. We've explained this in real time, interview after interview. The question is, why then do you go back to the U.S. House of Representatives and we got this guy, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, who's saying that we must put forward another Ukraine spending bill. And if they can just get, you know, and Tony, let me just ask you, so take the politics out of it. If we give Ukraine $10 billion more, $20 billion more, $60 billion more, is it going to change the fundamentals on the line of contact?
I don't know. Did the $300 billion we already spent make a difference? I don't know. You tell me. I mean, $300 billion, that's a lot of coin. You and I, if they gave us that money, we could take over the world. I mean, we'd be great James Bond villains. I'm just saying, Jack, I think we could do a good job. But there's no way any amount of additional money. It's never been about the money. It's about the strategy. It's about the lack of any understanding of what the Russians want, how they're going to accomplish it, and how to deal with that. They've ignored that. Victoria Nuland, Jake Sullivan, Tony Blinken, these people couldn't negotiate a nursery home visit for their to see their mom. I mean, they'd be barred from seeing her. So I think it's that bad. The other thing notable in the whole equation, and I think this is a bit of can I say ass covering on your show? I just did. There are already NATO forces on the ground. There's already NATO forces on the ground.
And this is what I was going to ask you about too, because it sounds like what they're doing is that this is CYA, because they know that there are operations that came out. And by the way, this happens all the time when the Russians will post some photos. They uncovered, you know, some documents or some patches of guys. They could say, hey, wait a minute, that's a French citizen. That's a U.S. soldier. And then we'll get these questions. Oh, they were operating without orders or away without leave, or, you know, all these different phrases. That guy was on leave and then he decided to join some unit. But that's not really what's going on, is it?
No, there's three categories of Westerners. NATO, I don't know what you want to call the group. They're not officially NATO, but they kind of are. And basically, you have provisioners who basically provide material. You have force retainers, that basically the guys who maintainers, the maintainers who actually do maintenance on things like the Patriot missile system. There's a bunch of missile systems and other military systems which are very sophisticated. You can't train a guy in 2 weeks how to run it. So you have people that, and then you have fighters. You have foreign fighters. And I think the most prevalent group of those foreign fighters at this point are the French. And I think that's why Macron is making all these noises about sending French in. I think they're already there. I think they've gotten waxed. I think they're not doing well. And I think Macron's trying to kind of let the French public know that they're doing this because they, you know, they're going to do it because they already are doing it. And I do believe Macron wants to try to bring the English in next once he gets the English in. And by the way, let me just say this for the record. If the French go in officially, they bring the British in officially, they're going to get whacked. Again, 40,000 is not going to make a difference when you're facing literally tens of thousands with Russians who are highly motivated and making progress. So,
well, and in addition to that, you say the British, you say the French, but you want to talk another Central European power there. the Germans going in, and we've already seen this with some German armor that's made its way to Ukraine. Now it was transferred over, but the German troops getting involved in Ukraine, that's going to stir up some memories for the Russians. And
oh, yeah,
it's certainly, now, as you say, I don't know that it changes necessarily the balance of power, but it stirs up some memories. And it really, if you want to talk public opinion, that's the kind of thing. If you say the Germans are marching against the Russian army again and they're in Ukraine again, you know, that's, you're going to get the Russians running around yelling rematch.
But I agree with you. I think there are elements of the German government who want that, but the German people don't. Most of the people, Jack, are thinking like we are. It's like, let's get this over with. This isn't helping our economy. This is not helping move civilization in the right direction. There are real enemies that we need to look at. And, you know, the Russians have, I think, a legitimate grievance. I've said this on your show. I've said it in other places. We are trying to jump into a civil war. Basically, the Russians and Ukrainians are cut from the same cloth. They have a system of oligarchs. They have a system of patronage. I'm not here to judge it. It works for them. Look, those systems love the strong man. They've had czars and secretaries of the Soviet. I mean, it is what it is. It's not our system, but it doesn't have to be our system. We just have to keep, to our P's and Q's. And I think the Europeans are pretty fed up. People, not the nations, but I think the people are pretty fed up with what's going on as well.
Well, Olaf Scholz, he's the least popular governing leader, political leader in all of Europe right now. The entire continent of Europe, least popular head is Olaf Scholz. And why? And this is the really sinister part of all of this. Because if folks remember, and I talk about this from time to time here, when they asked Lord Ismay, what was the purpose of NATO? The original NATO commander, they said, what's the purpose of NATO? And he said, the purpose of NATO is to keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. Who has been, right, qui bono? We always ask qui bono, who benefits from anything that happens, et cetera, but also qui malo? Who has suffered the most? Now, yes, obviously Ukraine has suffered the most in terms of material, but you want to talk outside the larger picture, it's the German economy and the German citizens have suffered greatly. I said this, by the way, I remember I said this day one, 2 years ago when the Russians rolled in, I said, boy, those Germans are sure going to be upset that they listened to Greta instead of Donald Trump when it came to Nord Stream 2. And Media Matters lost their mind and everybody's freaking out at me. And now here we are 2 years later and they're all in the slumps and they're going to lose their auto industry over this. You watch Mercedes-Benz and Volkswagen. Don't ask who founded them, by the way. And Audi and all the great German auto manufacturers are going to lose out on the back of this. Stay tuned. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, we're walking through the economic, military, and political fallout of the Ukraine war.
The hidden tales of the communist history. I want to know the truth, what really went down. So I'm jumping on my computer. Pre-order town. Pre-order in the U.S. Santa mystery. The hidden tales of the communist history. I want to know the truth, what really went down. So I'm jumping on my computer. Going to pre-order town. Pre-order in the U.S.
All right, Jack Posobiec back live, Human Events Daily, Washington, D.C. We're speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. We're talking about the economic and political fallout of the Ukraine war. It's become a debacle. It absolutely has become a tar baby in many cases. There's another angle to it that I wanted to bring up because we just got, and this is really in the last 24 hours, the former head of the U.K., David Cameron, the neoliberal whisperer, has flown down to Mar-a-Lago and held a meeting with President Trump specifically on urging support for more Ukraine military spending, saying the world is watching, we need to get involved. Tony, have you heard anything specifically about this meeting that David Cameron held with Trump? And even if not, why do you think that he went down and made this plea? It's obviously quite unusual going to a former president, also obviously someone who was a presidential candidate.
So I talked to a lot of folks who advise Trump on a regular basis, and none of them are talking about this. So I presume that there's not much to say. I just don't see there's any way Cameron or any other European leader, I'll be very polite in the way I address the Europeans, is going to have any impact on President Trump. It's just like there's no there for us. I think the best course is to let Trump move forward. He's put together a plan to end the war. I think he's sincere on that. That is President Trump. And I think that's what the Europeans don't want. The Europeans look at this as a way of paying bills. I think there's a number of initiatives that gives the Europeans the ability to essentially keep this going and become somewhat wet to the economics of defense spending. This is where they want to move their economy because the economy is so bad otherwise. So I think this is almost a Hail Mary, and I just don't think it's going to work. I don't think Trump's going to budge. But speaking of the economy and why it's so bad there, it's so bad, Jack, because of early decisions, to your point, Nord Stream 2 and other very effective and efficient means of transporting natural gas and oil to the Europeans has been cut off because, you know, reasons. Because the Europeans somehow thought that listening to Biden, and more importantly, Obama, and looking at how they promised, I think the European leaders were promised a Ukraine that would be part of the EU that would give them great benefit regarding oil, gas, and food. And you need to come with us and destabilize Ukraine for purposes of ending Russia. I think they were sold a bill of goods. They have nothing left now except to try to move their economy into some sort of a war footing that allows for them to manufacture weapons as a replacement for manufacturing cars and other goods which would be productive and useful to the world.
And it's interesting, too, because, as you say, this economic issue that they have is it's going to be massive. For the Germans, it's going to be massive, and I don't see how it doesn't affect their Germany is one of the last countries in all of the continent of Europe that has maintained its manufacturing base, right. Particularly because they maintained a lot of the protectionist, the worker protectionist policies and business protectionist policies that have been placed for a long time in Germany. At a time where the U.S. did not go down that road. We, of course, went to China and we said China's going to be our big manufacturer. They're going to be the factory of the world. And as such, we've watched and watched as our businesses have become more sinicized over the years. Even our manufacturers, right. Our car manufacturers, they say, great, yeah, it's got the Ford logo on it, but, you know, where did the parts come from and where were they assembled? And you get into the actual nitty gritty of all of it. Right. Obviously, you can, and I would certainly, by the way, this isn't just auto manufacturers, I would certainly and definitely apply that to, what's that company again? Oh, right, Boeing. So yeah, we've not taken good care of our manufacturers, but also, you know, in the name of cutting costs, we've screwed them over greatly, as well as the consumers and the workers. Now, the question I guess I have is the fact that Cameron's meeting with Trump, I mean, is this just kind of, you know, I wonder how much of a mea culpa is there, because Trump is the guy, number one, who warned them about all these things years ago. They didn't listen to him. They laughed in his face. It was Merkel back then. But also, I think it's just tacitly admitting that they know that Trump is ascendant in America, and that more than likely they're going to be negotiating with him in the White House rather than the guy who's currently there.
I think if all things being equal, Jack, the election goes and the actual results are recorded and acted on, President Trump will be the 47th president, no doubt. And I think the British know that. The Germans know that. I think the Europeans know deep down that the gravy train with Biden is going to end. And I mean, again, if everything goes well, we've talked about off air. We want to do a show just on election issues, and I think we should do that at some point. But for now, I'm sure you want me to focus on Ukraine. But I think in this case, is a Hail Mary.
Just real quick, we're definitely, I mean, Tony, you've been a little vocal about election issues lately, and I think it definitely bears a one day when we've got a little bit
again.
More time,
it's
we should sit
again.
Down. Yeah, we should sit down.
It's come up.
And it's there. It's, what can I say, folks? Tony Schaefer strikes fear into the hearts of the globalists, whether they're on the global stage or here on the domestic stage, and that's why we have him on as much as we possibly can.
So, but very quick back to the economic issue. Greta Thunberg is literally the Pied Piper of destruction. If she gets her way, how dare you steal my childhood? I can't believe my hair's all messed up. Anyway, the issue regarding her and what she's done is insane by the fact that she has essentially put the Germans on a path of destruction. There's no coming back. They want to move their economy into a pre-industrial status. They're shutting down their nuclear plants. They're stepping away from fossil fuels. Not even fossil fuels. They're just hydrocarbons. And, Jack, it's very dangerous. And what's going to happen is you see this very productive, very amazing economy in Europe, the Germans, literally sliding into disrepair and failure. And it's all because the Germans and others have listened to the globalists and people like Greta Thunberg and not Donald Trump. And I think Trump's going to stay strong, and I think he's going to try to encourage them to do the right thing once he comes back in office in 2025.
Look, we've got people say, oh, we need security threats. We have security threats. We have security threats. But here's the problem. And this is a huge issue, by the way, when it comes to security policy, because this has been NATO's issue all along, because as NATO said, they need to push further and further east to ensure security. No one sat down and ever considered whether or not the Russians looked at that as an escalating threat from NATO.
I had a conversation, the same words, with a former member of the Reagan cabinet just this morning on this very topic, Jack, and that was the issue. And the issue was, maybe, you know, when they started doing this, they should have actually engaged the Russians to say, this is not, we're not coming for you. You need to let the Russians know. And instead, you instilled and reinforced a paranoia that goes back to the invasion of, I believe, what was the group here? I have it written down. The Mongols. 1237, you know, the Russians have been invaded over and over.
The Golden
Horde. 1237.
You got the Golden Horde. Yeah. And then, of course, not, you know, hundreds of years later, you've got the French under Napoleon came in. Yeah. Moscow was in flames at the end of that. Then the Grand Army leaves. Then, of course, in the 19th, which is living in, there are people who, for whom World War II is still living memory.
Exactly.
Over there.
The
and
great
so
patriotic
that's
war.
Why. This, the Great Patriotic War, May 9th, huge day, missile parades, everybody knows it. And so I don't think people realize how
ingrained,
different and ingrained World War II was for them. For us, it was like, you know, some people's grandparents, great grandparents may have gone over to fight, and it was over there. For them, it wasn't over there. It was in your homes, and it was in your neighborhoods, and it was your, you know, your sister was the one getting raped, or your aunt, you know, or like that one member of the family who disappeared and no one ever knows what happened. They lost 30 million people. I'm not talking about the Soviets. I'm talking about the people of Russia. And by the way, Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus, right? So they're all, as you say, cut from the same cloth. This all goes into their thinking, and it's not something you can just, you know, just turn off, because it's so, it is so recent and it's so baked into everything that goes on over there. So from their perspective, just the Russian security posture in general, you've got this huge hinterland of Ukraine, the breadbasket, which sure, it's great for agriculture, but you know what, also it's really good for invading, because there's no natural barriers whatsoever. And that's why they come in with the hard hand that we see. And it seems that over the years that the leaders of NATO just completely discounted all of this.
They didn't discount it, Jack. They decided that they were smarter than the average bear and decided to poke the bear. Mm. This is all about poking the bear. I'm a Reagan guy. I talk to the Reagan guys all the time, just include this morning. And everybody recognizes on the team I play on that you need to understand your adversary. Reagan understood those things that we're talking about and acted on them in a way that actually allowed for us to gain victory during the Cold War without having to go to World War III, at the same time recognizing that that defeating the evil empire was important. We don't have people who have that level of understanding of the Russians to actually understand what their issues are and deal with their issues. Instead, it's all antagonism and being antagonistic. and deciding
they get their policy prescriptions from watching Marvel movies and say we're the Avengers and we're going to go after the bad guys and like yeah. some you know cape movie and that's how you win. Tony Schaefer, incredible insight. I hope to God that we get a situation where we have a president who's listening to people like you and not listening to people like David Cameron. Where people go to follow you and support
Thanks,
you.
Thanks, Jack. ProjectSentinel.com, and you and I are always chasing each other on Twitter, and it's always fun. So thanks for having me, Jack. Good to be here.
All right, we're going to do an election special coming up because I think that's been brewing. I think it's been brewing. Stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back. Joshua Lysak, co-author of Unhuman Space. I want to know the truth, what really went down, so I'm jumping on my computer, going to pre-order town. All right, Jack Posobiec here, live, Human Events Daily, Washington, D.C. We've got Joshua Lysak on, the co-author of Unhumans, The Secret History of Communist Revolutions and How to Crush Them. Joshua, the theme of today's show is power politics. And this is something where I've noticed that the right is just, I mean, I was just going to say it, it's just deficient. It's just very deficient because the right will like to argue philosophy essentially all the time. And yet they'll do so without any leverage whatsoever. And in the span of that, I think they're missing the fact that well, while they're spending all their time arguing, shooting within the tent, purity spirals, that you know who is taking power is the left. And that eventually that ends up in, well, a lot of things that are written about in our book. the slaughter of the Romanovs, the struggle sessions of Mao, the mass executions in Spain. And, you know, boy, imagine if the other, you know, imagine if the situation reversed. Imagine if the opposite was happening. Imagine if the roles were reversed. And what is this pathology that exists on the right, if you can explain it to me, in such a way where the right refuses to focus on taking power?
Yes, this is something that we see in the present, and we've seen it in the past as well, going back almost three centuries. In Unhumans, when we look at how forces of anti-civilization have overcome a society, how they've risen up by assembling a coalition of the underclasses, the disenfranchised, and the discontented and the malcontents of a society, they're able to topple governments that in some cases had existed for hundreds of years, in the case of the absolute monarchy of France, or even in thousands of years with the overthrow of the old order in China that was toppled by two successive communist revolutions. What the left understands is that the objective is to get power, is to organize and get power. What we don't see that from the right, what we see instead from the right is, as you said, Jack, a sort of purity spiraling where there's more so an agenda. There's competing agendas. The left understands that the agenda is to win. What we see effectively the left being able to do in these far left wing uprisings is they organize to get power. They infiltrate institutions. They find themselves the coalition that is going to want power. And so they are of a singular mind and a singular will. And that is the will to rule. What we see instead from the right is fear of power and an inability to organize. And we see that how even in the various factions, there's intra-Christian conflicts, whether it's regarding social issues or moral issues, or even what's anti-Semitic versus what's not anti-Semitic. Well, if you're the right kind of Christian, then you can't be an anti-Semite, right? Well, no, that's not the case. And then there's these bickering, and then there's blocking, and then this continual fragmentation. And the brain of the right is sort of self-isolating one hemisphere from the other. And it's been this way for hundreds of years. We saw this in monarchist France. We saw this with the White Army. Peter Wrangel, who successfully for a time, pushed back against the Bolsheviks' Red Army until ultimately, unfortunately, they were defeated and driven from Russia. Peter Wrangel himself dealt with generals with their own agendas, seeking their own glory. And this is the difference between seeking of glory and power. What we see from the left is seeking of power. What we see from the right is the seeking of their own glory. How I'm the one, I'm the man, I'm the hero. Well, what Peter Wrangel identified was that if they had unanimously organized, done the same thing, all of the generals, all of the leaders of the various parts of the White Army, if they had all together risen up and fought back with a single strategy rather than I want to be the one who does it, I want to be the winner, they would have won. We notice this happened successfully under Generalissimo Francisco Franco when he and his generals united with one mind and one will. And that one will was, wherever we are, there will be no communism. So they were united by a common enemy. We will do whatever it takes to win. There was only victory. Reading the transcripts of some of the speeches that he gave, you understand this. This was someone who was able to roll up all power into his hand, and he held it gently, like one might hold a small owl egg, for example. Holding the power, yes, but gently, not squeezing it like the modern day conservative influencer and see as the egg cracks and the yolk of grace, mercy, compassion, and goodwill oozes out through their fingers and they lose it. And that's the story of the Republican conservative.
You know, there was even a line I remember reading, I believe when we were doing some research on Franco, because people this all wasn't happening in vacuums the way it's taught in U.S. History class. These were all happening one after another on the continent of Europe. So Russia happens in 1917. Then you have various communist movements throughout Central Europe in 1919, 1920. They attempt to take over Poland. Turns the Red Army back at the Miracle in the Vistula, the Battle of Warsaw. And then you have Franco in Spain and the Rojas who take control of the Spanish government. And I believe there's a British commentator who actually said something along the lines of, if the Russian generals had just fought like these Spaniards under Franco, then they would have won their war against the Reds as well. And so getting back to that pathology that you just said, it almost seems like it's a, I'm just going to say it, it seems like it's a fetishization of martyrdom, a fetishization of martyrdom that some conservatives seem to have, to say, I want to be part of the group that gets led into the forest and shot for my beliefs. Like, this is some kind of great idea. Whereas Patton, I believe, said that the goal of warfare is quite the opposite.
Yes, exactly. To paraphrase Patton gently, the objective of warfare is to make the enemy die for their cause and their country rather than you to die for theirs. So as you know, Jack, I grew up in the evangelical Christian community, very, very conservative space. That is a subculture that many people are familiar with. And in that space, I've critiqued that community for the fetishization of martyrdom. There are songs, there are movies, there are sermons. There's this whole sort of, let's say, entertainment vertical. Strange as that sounds, it's an entertainment vertical about so martyrdom true. And how wonderful it is. And how wouldn't it be amazing if, like, the government was overtaken and if it was seized by atheistic communists and they killed all of us for our beliefs and so we could get to be led into the arena like the ancient Christians in Rome? Wouldn't that just be amazing? And of course, a very popular art in that particular subculture is artwork depicting the martyrdom of various Christian saints. It's a rather strange place to be in. And so if that is what your ideal is, if that is the ideal of being a Christian, and that is for the evangelical community, although there's some strange stuff with the end times and Israel being the clock, Mike Cernovich has spoken on this at length.
Oh, we've had Taylor Marshall on for some good comments on dispensationalism.
Yeah, yes, precisely.
But it comes from the same place. It comes from the exact same place.
Yes, exactly. Fortunately, Catholic, Orthodox, and other Protestant sects like the Latter-day Saints don't hold any of those beliefs, but there are still quite a few evangelicals who have power. And so the reason that we're sending billions to other countries other than to our own people is explained by the premillennial dispensationalism of evangelicals, as well as the inability to organize and hold and retain power. Because having power is to be like Nero, who is the bad guy. And this isn't necessarily outward and obvious. It's subconscious. It's subliminal. And yet it permeates that part of the American Christian world. The idea is to be killed, not to be in a position where you could kill, but you show your enemies mercy. And so what we're advocating for in this book and through messaging on this is that particularly the evangelical Christian community in America, who is a significant voter bloc and who very well could nominate people into positions of power, what we are advocating that they reframe is that it's okay to be a righteous ruler. It is okay to organize and to have not exactly absolute power, as we'll call it, brothers, but it's okay to have
lead the country,
power.
To lead the country. To
exactly.
Lead the country forward into a new future. Stay tuned, folks. We'll be right back. Fascinating. Can't wait to get my hands on that
far. But I got a hankering, a yearning deep inside. For this book called Unhumans, I just can't hide.
Jack Posobiec back live here, Human Events Daily. We are talking about the fact that millions of conservatives get this strange, you know, phenomenon when it comes to wielding power, when it comes to actually fighting back and fighting the left. And we've seen the same type of thinking. I'm not going to say the same strand because it's for different reasons. But you see it in Russia. You saw it in some elements of China, not all, but some, during the Communist Revolution and actually revolutions. You saw it in certainly America in many cases. You saw it in France. We see it in France. And in the book on humans, we walk through this, where even the King of France went along with the revolutionaries as they were making their reforms and saying, oh, I'm good. You know, I'm putting up the BLM square. I'm marching in the marches. I'm putting my fist up. They'll never come for me. All down to the time where they walk up to him and say, hello, King Louis. We need to see you and your wife downstairs for a quick minute. And then we know exactly what happened to that. Joshua, you and I were talking during the break, and you said something that was I found absolutely fascinating. You said that there are those in the conservative sphere, many of whom come, not all, but many of whom come from evangelical Christianity, who almost have something like a victim mentality when it comes to some of this stuff, when it comes to wielding power. What does that mean?
Yes, there's an inherent nobility in victimhood, and there's an almost an allergy to power. Quick anecdote. There was a basketball team that my team played when I was a youngster, and there's a little local controversy about the team having changed their name. The former name of the team had been Crusaders, this sort of mascot.
Great.
Right? And it was changed to
extremely
Eagles
based.
From Crusaders, because there were some evangelical moms of the basketball players at this high school team that deemed Crusader offensive, because Crusaders were powerful people. They were conquerors, and they kind of did some killing, and maybe it was defensive, maybe it's not, but that's kind of offensive. And so because it was involving Christians having and holding political power, that's not okay. So they sanitized the name and changed it from the Crusaders to the Eagles. They went unopposed, of course, in this name change. And we see this as well with other sports teams changing their name from something that was powerful, bold, masculine to something that's kind of neutral or perhaps neutered, let's say. And that little anecdote is emblematic, symbolic, demonstrative, illustrative of the resistance to political power. If you ask a typical evangelical Christian, what's your opinion about Constantine, the Roman Emperor Constantine? You will get mixed to negative reviews. I have done this personally and had these conversations. Now, of course, if you ask a Catholic, Orthodox, or other, let's say, more traditional Christians, you'll get a rather different response. But there's a sort of resistance, and even there was a sermon I remember as a child in which it was pointed out that Constantine wasn't a real Christian. He, in fact, was simply using Christianity to hold power in the Roman Empire and roll it up in the 4th, 5th century, right around that time frame. And so that resistance to political power, call it an allergy, call it what have you, there is some guilt around it. Dare we say white guilt, possibly, even in that for the evangelical Christian?
Oh, I would say white guilt is a huge part of this.
Yes. And it's typically with your white evangelicals who have this and kind of feeling bad, like, well, you know, there were some white Christians who killed some not so white, not so Christians during the Crusades, and that wasn't okay, and that wasn't cool. You know, so when Christians get power, those who are super aggressive among us can kind of use our religion and use the power we have to do some not so nice things. And, you know,
and by the way, I've got to throw out there. It was specifically the sacking of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre that led Pope Urban to launch the First Crusade. It was the Muslim Arabs who attacked the Holy Land and had already controlled the Holy Land for a while before the First Crusade was launched, but specifically going in and sacking the church, which at that time had been, and my belief is that it is the correct church, had been ordained by Constantine, his mother, St. Helena, to be the actual tomb of Christ and the actual place where pilgrims went to visit the rock of Golgotha, the place of Calvary. And they went and desecrated that church. That was where the Crusades came from. But of course, if you eliminate all that history and at least the historical understanding, you don't have to get into all the theological background, fine, right? But understand the history. This was the reason for the First Crusade.
Yes, that's all right. And it also explains the resistance to figures like Peter Wrangel being this Christian warrior, resistance to Pinochet, resistance to Franco, these Christian and Christian, and as I say, Christendom aligned heroes, these great men of history who did what they had to in order to crush communism and the forces of anti-civilization. It was not nice what they did because they used the power of the state.
We only got about a minute left here, but that it strikes me as interesting that something that we've discovered through going through all of this, a lot of these anti-communists who have been slandered by history, or shall we say blacklisted by history, were themselves actually very devout Christians.
Yes, but in this time in which we think in labels, all it takes for millions of Christian Republicans to dismiss the work and the legacy of Franco entirely is to put the adjective in front of his name, fascist. Oh, he's fascist. Oh, fascist. Oh, you mean like Mussolini, like Hitler? Okay, bad. Okay, so we just got to put him in the segment of doing everything.
Or worse, they'll call him the conservatarians, and they call him statist. Oh, a statist. Oh no, not a statist. Not using the power of the state. No. We've all got to run off to our ranches. Of course, then we'll be safe in the pastoral rural lands, just like the Shire was perfectly safe when Sauron got the Ring of Power. Joshua Lysak, always a pleasure, man. Appreciate you jumping on at the last minute. Where can people go specifically to follow you, because they already know where to get the book?
Yes, I'm at Joshua Lysak on Twitter, now X.
Go follow him, guys. Joshua Lysak. Ladies and gentlemen, as always, you have my permission. Play short.
Tells a story of secrets and a mystery. The hidden tales of the communist history.